Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. At an age when my big obsession was where to find the next big wiffle ball game, Petter Gynns was inventing secret codes, making watercolors, and writing novels, five of them by the age of 14. Petter was murdered by the Nazis 2 years later, but his amazing life and the many lives he touched in and out of the concentration camps are remembered and celebrated in the Wake Forest University production of Embers and Stars, the story of Petter Gynns. Then film scholar Mary Dalton takes us behind the scenes to answer that nagging question, what exactly makes a movie romantic? Winston-Salem Forsyth County Arts Council President and CEO Jim Sparrow's got an artistic vision that'll rock, jazz, classical, and folk your world. Then we're off to the dance at High Point University. Kara Hagen is here with a choreographer's keen eye for storytelling, and touring theater of North Carolina actor Camilla Milliken has a Valentine's Day card that'll take you over the edge. Next on Triad Arts Weekend after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we've got theater, dance, and arts administration savvy all in one big program today, beginning and ending with the stage. Petter Gynns was a real-life boy genius. He wrote and illustrated five novels before his 15th birthday, taught himself new languages, established a periodical magazine, and immersed himself in sociology, literature, painting, geography, and various technical fields as well. Sadly, many of those pursuits took place in the Terezin concentration camp. Petter was eventually assigned to one of the last trains to Auschwitz, where he died in the gas chambers there in 1944. The Diary of Petter Gynns, 1941-42, was published in English in 2004. It's been favorably compared to the diaries of Anne Frank and Victor Klemperer, and it forms the basis of a new theatrical production by the Wake Forest University Department of Theater, Embers and Stars, The Story of Petter Gynns. Professor of Theater Cindy Gendrick directs the play. She stopped by along with Wake Forest University student actors Sarah Davis, who plays Eva Gynns, Zach Pierce Messick, who plays Professor Eisinger, and assistant director dramaturg Joe Beach.
Petter's story was really captivating from the very beginning. He is very imaginative. He wrote his own books as a 14-year-old. He started this magazine, Vedum, with the boys in his barrack in Terezin, the camp he was in. And he was a great leader and inspired all the boys. And one of my favorite quotes from the play that actually Petter wrote once was, I'm not going to get the wording exactly right, but the seed of creative life does not die in mud and scum. And so I think that was really the point that captivated me the most about him.
I found it really interesting in the interview with his, and this is, you know, 60 years later, his sister saying that he wrote about facts. He knew that he would remember the feelings, but he was afraid he might forget the facts. Is that something to consider?
Well, we're using one of his novels, the only one that actually still exists, called A Visit from Prehistory. And a big part of it, it's also in the film, it's this monster Kadu that's a metaphor for the Nazis. And we're actually using shadow puppets, and the boys enact the book through puppets on stage. And it's funny and interesting and strange and kind of wonderful. And they make sound effects, and it all feels very much like boys playing, but it has this serious undertone to it because, of course, the book did too. I mean, he was pretty prescient about seeing the Nazi machine and all of the sort of monstrous things that they were doing. And he wrote this when he was only, I think, 12.
That's amazing. I was interested in his work, even within the concentration camp, to kind of chronicle what was going on there. I was just looking at Flowers at Night and Moon Landscape. How would you describe those? I mean, through the magic of radio, he definitely has his own style.
I think that there's a real range in his work from rather abstract pieces. There's one that is just a bunch of different lines and squares and designs, to more concrete representations of his location and where he was and what he saw. And so I think we can gather information from both of these types of work in terms of his feelings and his emotions towards his location. But I think the ones that he did in Terezin are really interesting because some of them are darker and show more of the struggle that was going on, but some of them are really beautiful and show the nature and the beauty that was still there in the camp.
calling from these different disciplines and putting this story together. I mean, it must have been a challenge. How did you go about it?
I was part of the class that this project originally started with. Cindy taught the class. It was called Development and Performance. And we first took the diary and watched the film, the documentary, and kind of developed a piece that we wrote based on that work and on the diary. And from that point was when Cindy and Andy White of Looking Glass Theater decided that they wanted to create a full-length script out of it. And so then, over the summer, while they were developing, Cindy and I and Rob, who's another professor in the department, traveled to Prague to gather more of a sense of Petter's world. From that point, we also read lots of books. Cindy read a lot of books. I read a lot of books, some different, some the same. Did a lot of research as much as we could. And actually, what the audience won't necessarily know is that most of the entire script is true. It happened. A lot of the small anecdotes, I mean, there is some creative license, definitely, but a lot of the anecdotes are just true stories. We actually met with Hava, Petter's sister, who's still alive in Prague, and she gave us a lot of really great stories we could use. Putting it all together and deciding what was most important to tell was probably one of the most difficult parts for Cindy and Andy. And now we're, you know, in the production of it and getting to actually bring it to life, so it's really exciting.
Have you read the diary? Have you read through it?
It's actually published in a book with the introduction by Eva, and so she wrote the introduction, and I have read everything in the diary that's by her, and then a lot of the diary is actually just a list of everything that he did that day. You were saying before, it's the diary is just the facts, and it really is. It's today it was cloudy, and I went to Manini, and I saw my cousin Pavel. And so it's very methodical, and it actually all takes place before he was transported to Terezin.
And Terezin, one of the concentration camps?
It was a transit camp, so it wasn't like a death camp. This is the place where they put all the musicians and the artists and the writers and a lot of the children and older people. And they fooled some German Jews into believing that they were being sent to a spa. And this is the place that the Red Cross was asked to kind of go and check out some of the camps, right? And so this is the camp that they dressed up and tried to make look nice for the Red Cross visit.
Oh, and they put on that big play for all the dignitaries.
They put on Brundibar, right?
Brundibar.
Right. They did Brundibar, and they sang Verdi's Requiem. And as we say in the play, they saw both of these things and missed the symbolism entirely.
Wow.
And they didn't try to see anything that the Nazis didn't want them to see. And so it ended up being, you know, just a completely fruitless thing, and they left satisfied and said that the conditions were acceptable there.
Zach, who was Professor Eisinger?
He is one of the many people that was in Terezin that took the initiative to be a leader for the incredible amount of intellectuals and children that were there. He actually was married in the camp to his lover, who he knew before getting sent to Terezin. There are actually quite a few weddings that happened in Terezin, so that's a really interesting juxtaposition when you think about what should be happy as a wedding happening inside of one of these camps. He chose, out of his own free will, to stay in the same bunks as Petter and all the boys. That was his decision. He didn't have to stay there. They actually had in the camp a place for all of the adults to stay, but he said, nope, I'm going to be a role model for these children because it's important.
Hmm. Now, how much of an impact did he have on Petter's life in terms of the choices he made while he was in that transit location?
I never actually saw anything that Petter had written about Eisinger's influence, but he kind of acted like one of the boys. He was a troublemaker in the sense that I remember there's one story that one of the boys told where there was a surprise inspection of the bunks that the boys had, and they had recently made the entire bunk look like a famous city. And obviously that's against the rules. And so Eisinger, being the adult, he'd be the person to talk with the SS. And as all the boys are lined up in the bunk, Eisinger's talking to the SS. He's making fun of the SS to their face. And all the boys are, you know, biting their tongues, trying not to laugh because it's the SS. You don't want to mess with them. But Eisinger obviously was a really smart guy to be able to make fun of someone to their face without them even knowing.
Talking about creating the city on a mattress made me think of this notion that even within those confines, Petter's continuing to learn, continuing to research. And what sorts of things was he doing while he was there that would kind of expand the mind?
Well, he taught himself geography. He drew maps of the world and did all of the little details on several continents and all of Africa. He read Descartes. He read all of Jules Verne. There's a whole list of the things that he taught himself while he was there, because what happened was that the Nazis had actually confiscated about 60,000 books from the Jews who were brought into the camp. And they, for whatever reason, actually let them use the books. And so, strangely enough, even though they weren't supposed to be having classes, they had classes there. And the boys kept reading and they kept learning and growing and writing their own magazine. So,
wow.
Kind of wonderful.
Well, remind our listeners about Looking Glass, Cindy, and the collaboration that's spun out of this.
Sure. So the Looking Glass Theater in Chicago is doing some of the most exciting theater work in the country. They won the Tony for Best Regional Theater in, I think, 2011. Might be 2012. anyway, they're this great group that does all kinds of new work, very physical, strongly invested in telling stories in the most theatrical way they possibly can. And their artistic director, Andy White, is a good friend of Peter Gilbert's, who works in our documentary film program. And Peter thought that it would be really cool to create some kind of connection between Wake Forest and Looking Glass. And so Sandy Dixon in documentary film had just done this beautiful film, The Last Flight of Peter Gintz. And he thought that it would be interesting, or they thought that it would be interesting, to see if that might be made into a theater piece. And so we brought Andy in. He did some master classes. We kind of hit it off. And this collaboration was born. And Andy and another colleague of his, Tracy Walsh, came in during my development and performance class that Joe just mentioned, and they did workshops with us. Andy came to see the final piece that was about 40 minutes long of us developing a bunch of movement vocabulary and parts of the storyline, and he's been just this amazing collaborator, and he'll be back for the premiere, and if we think that this is something that might be good for them to take on, then Looking Glass could take it and do something with it in Chicago, and it could go quite a bit further. So it's just been, it's been such a joyful collaboration, and that seems like a strange word talking about a, you know, a play about the Holocaust, but it really has been this kind of amazing long-distance collaboration, and sometimes not so long-distance. It's been a really interesting, moving, and expanding, enriching kind of experience for me too, and an emotional one at times too.
Wake Forest University Professor of Theater Cindy Gendrick, Wake Forest University student actors Sarah Davis and Zach Pierce-Messick, and assistant director, dramaturg Joe Beach. The play is Embers and Stars, the story of Peter Gintz. It opens Sunday, February 23rd at 2 o'clock in the Scales Fine Arts Center's Ring Theater on the Wake Forest campus. And you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we'll be back with more Triad Arts Weekend after a short break. Mary Dalton takes us behind the scenes this Valentine's Day weekend with the makings of a romantic film next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and coming up later on the show, we'll check out the dance scene at High Point University, share a hilarious but very dark Valentine's Day monologue or two, and spend a little time in the shoes of an Arts Council president and CEO. But first, Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies, Mary Dalton, is all set to take us behind the scenes.
I've been known to say that I'm an incurable romantic, but that I cultivate a veneer of cynicism because life so seldomly meets our expectations that it might just be better not to have any expectations at all. One place I can let go of that veneer and give myself over to the moment is at the movies. And what is it that makes a movie romantic? I think the most compelling love stories have a mystical element pulsing through the human connection. For me, I have noticed three patterns: really seeing, communicating without words, and lyrical expressions of love. First, the idea of seeing and not hiding. It's a step beyond looking. You look at someone, but then you really see the person. In Last of the Mohicans, which I think is a very romantic movie, she returns his gaze, and it goes much deeper, turning looking into really seeing one another, regardless of the consequences. And of course, Last of the Mohicans is enhanced by a particularly stirring score. Another really romantic movie is The Secret in Their Eyes, an Argentinian film. And this illustrates the concept of communicating without words, because maybe there are no words for certain types of convergences. I always think wistfully of the train scene in The Secret in Their Eyes and how ignoring those convergences and what is unspoken but known has big and sometimes sad consequences. A third element that I think is romantic is lyricism. And what could be more beautiful and lyrical than Before Sunset? The film shot in the magic hour. There's the playfulness of the characters and the fluid expressive elements of the filmmaking, the sense of hope, of possibility. This film has all of that and more played out in real time. If you're looking for a special movie to share with a special person on Valentine's Day, maybe one of these will be suitable. Or maybe you'll just want to regain a bit of youthful passion and innocence and go to my favorite 80s teen pick, Say Anything. Haven't seen it? Surely you remember the iconic image of John Cusack's character, Lloyd Dobler, with a boombox hoisted over his head, serenading his love.
In your eyes, the light, the heat, of all the fruitless soldiers.
It occurs to me now that Say Anything hinges on Lloyd really seeing Diane and her coming to see him, that there are important things between them that are unspoken but not unknown, and that there is a bit of lyricism woven throughout too. So maybe Cameron Crowe's 1980s teenage love story is the perfect movie to watch on Valentine's Day. I'm so glad that I have a copy handy.
Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies, Mary Dalton, in a little old segment we like to call Behind the Scenes. You can check out Mary's blog on our website, WFDD.org. We've got modern dance and a dark but hilarious Valentine's Day tribute for you on the second half of the show, but first we'll spend some time with an Arts Council CEO. Jim Sparrow began his artistic career as a classically trained clarinetist, studying at the prestigious Cleveland Institute of Music, and shortly after graduating, becoming principal clarinetist with the Fort Wayne Philharmonic. During Jim's decade-long tenure with that orchestra, his interest in arts and arts management continued to grow. He eventually left that post to run Arts United of Greater Fort Wayne, where he helped transform Northeast Indiana into a thriving scene spanning the whole spectrum of the arts. In October 2013, Jim Sparrow took over the reins long held by Milton Rhodes as president and CEO of the Arts Council of Winston-Salem in Forsyth County. 4 months into the job, he's already actively working towards enhancing the artistic offerings at the Rhodes Center and all along Spruce Street. Jim's excited about the prospect of adding additional layers of activity and diversity to what Winston-Salem already offers, and he stopped by WFDD recently to talk about it. In terms of potential for this area artistically, where are some of the hot spots along those lines that interest you most, I should say?
Sure. I actually think the community is positioned really well to be a destination city. We look at what happened over the last 20 years or so with cities like Chattanooga, Asheville, and Greenville, cities that 25 years ago no one would have ever stopped in, and now have built a reputation as a destination of some kind. And I see many of the same things here. Primary assets such as Rinalda House, Sika, Old Salem. I mean, these are huge assets that we can build off of. So I see huge assets there, along with, you know, obviously some really strong pockets as it relates to artisan craftsmen, artists. You know, there's a pocket here that is well established and evolving, not only here but regionally. And then also the proximity in terms of the performing arts and school of the arts as it relates to creating artists and being, you know, sort of a potential hotbed for the emerging artist and the performing arts from that aspect. So those things are all, I think, opportunities.
I'm glad you raised Asheville, because it seems like that's an area that people just kind of take for granted now as a hot spot, a tourism attracting area, but you don't have to go far back. What beyond the Biltmore sorts of changes took place infrastructurally or along any lines, along in that community that you may be aware of that you feel might be a model for change?
Sure. I think some of it is taking some of the natural attributes that that community had. They're in the mountains. It has the potential to be a more picturesque. I mean, many of the same things Winston has the opportunity to be. So you capitalize on that to start with. But you did have the Biltmore House as something that no other community really has if you elevate that. But then taking that smaller community, in many cases, there's large numbers of shops that were vacant, and saying, you know, this is a ready-built opportunity with infrastructure here to infill. What would be the way to infill? And starting the festivals that they've started, I think that's one thing to learn from. Do something that you're naturally set up to do and have the infrastructure and just capitalize on that. I think the other thing that Asheville has been proactive about is marketing itself, putting the investment of public-private dollars and emphasis, knowing that those things will pay dividends in great amount.
Public-private partnership. We hear that often.
And the thing that's interesting, you know, a lot of times people have an aversion to the concept of public funding or public cultural trust. And what I immediately caution them with is, if you look at various communities who have employed some type of public-private, there is as many different ways to do that as there are communities. It's really about saying, how can we get both sides invested in a way that's mutually beneficial and doesn't rely on one or the other exclusively. And I've used as caution too, it's not just for the arts. The arts benefit from that, but I stress that it's really about community development and having a tool that the community can access when the project is right.
As Executive Director of the Arts United of Greater Fort Wayne, just some of the takeaways from that experience that you think could apply in this area.
One of the takeaways I see is that mid-sized cities actually are big enough to matter in that they have systems that look like the bigger cities, function much that way, but are small enough to begin to modify. So when you talk about an integrated model system, which I believe is part of the future, a different way of actually operating, not just programming, operating, you can begin to tweak those in a mid-sized city, and when they're successful, everybody notices.
Let's just look at this downtown cultural arts district, or the
sure.
arts district of downtown. Here it is, 2014. Where do you see it in 5-10 years down the road? What are some of the things that you'd like to see happen there, or like to, you know, work toward in terms of this change we're talking about?
Well, I think there are a lot of steps that have been taken in the last 20 years that are good steps. The Stevens Center actually is a lovely facility. It is in need of some adaptation or modifications. The Rhodes Center and the Hanesbrands Theater have great potential. The development of what I call sort of an entertainment or a performing arts spine within, you know, the downtown, I think, is part of the next evolution. And with that, not only activity, but a multitude of options for activity spaces and integration. So the Hanesbrands is a great start at 300 seats. A Stevens Center with 1,400 seats, regardless of how we move up and down, is you know, the big space for town for the moment. But looking at ways that we continue to adapt what we already have, more flexible spaces, things that allow more activity, but integrated, you know, we can do more in terms of shared marketing, shared ticketing, shared activity. I think the closeness and proximity also leads well to a different way of operating and programming that becomes more community-centric. With that, too, that activity blurring the lines a little more as it relates to being on that cultural spectrum. I love the traditional fine arts. I also like the grassroots. I think it's all part of the same spectrum, but it's on different ends, but not diametrically opposed ends. They're just part of that whole great canvas that we talk about. That activity center and that spine, I think, can potentially be a nucleus or a hub where it wouldn't be impossible to see opera on a Saturday night, but also see local bands and food trucks on Spruce Street, and activity that might include a variety of things in terms of experimental theater, traditional theater at the Rhodes Center at the same time that people are taking classes at the Sawtooth. That, I think, is a vision that is not only exceptional for Winston-Salem, but also is exceptional for many communities. They would see it as a model. This is a new way of looking at how we integrate.
Yeah, I have that sense that there is a sort of high art here and,
right.
and everything else there, where it needn't be. If it's there for everybody, you might be more apt to try something new.
I agree. And I think one of the things that I've always found with my musician friends, they're interested in all kinds of music. I mean, they may be classically trained and they may be listening to Beethoven, Brahms, and Dvorak, but they'll also go to the new bands. They'll see what's happening with jazz. So they're just interested in music. So I think that's probably true of a lot of people. They don't completely feel comfortable venturing into new experiences. A lot of it has to do with, I think, the environment and how they approach it. And I've never been a big fan of this whole, well, if we bring them in at what we consider a lowbrow event, then we can sort of convert them. I think you make people music lovers. If you make people music lovers, they'll discover the spectrum. I like to use the term, and I've used it often, instead of talking about artists, I talk about creatives. Because when you get around creative people, you find that there's usually an artistic root of some kind. But there is also, when we talk about innovation, it's about finding creative solutions. It's about opening those doors. Arts are a great place to learn how to do that. They're also mixed with science and education and technology and a variety of things. So I think when we talk about becoming a really innovative place, it's really about how we provide opportunities for that person who wants to start the next great restaurant from a food truck, or the person who wants the next application, or the next great art form. They're all basically talking about doing something that's exceptional and creative and interesting. And that's where I think people gravitate.
And it's the Arts Council's job to make that ground fertile, or to make it inviting, or to facilitate that creative launching pad?
I think it is. I feel like one of the benefits of the Arts Council, while I think traditionally the Arts Council has been seen as sort of a steward for the traditional arts organizations, I think that's the genesis of when they were formed. I mean, when you look at 1949, most communities had 4 or 5 traditional arts groups, and that's about it. And the definition in terms of arts was much more finite than it is now. It's much broader now. One of the fastest growing industries or sectors in the United States is creative industries sector development. As you look at creating these new communities, one of the things that we have to focus on is advancing, coordinating, and supporting these types of efforts, both traditional and non-traditional. I think the Arts Council, or an Arts Council, most specifically ours here, is positioned better than anybody to begin to help that work. And if it's done correctly, it should help both ends of that spectrum. The traditional groups should benefit from that sense of artistic or creative juice, as well as people who are interested in learning more about what's happening. At the same time, it's fertile ground now for new ideas and new people and new things. And when we really talk about communities we like to go to, it's because they're interesting. We want to spend time in them. We feel comfortable in them, whatever it is we're interested in.
And that last part's so important, too, just feeling comfortable.
Yeah, and I think Winston-Salem is very much, very close to being that. I've heard of a lot of conversations since I've been here about the various projects, you know, the Innovation Corridor, and I think it's great. But I think we need to spend a little more time understanding that Winston-Salem is a patchwork of a series of cultural neighborhoods. It's not an either-or proposition. The Innovation Corridor needs to succeed, and it will succeed in whatever it becomes. But this entertainment or theater district type of concept is just one more neighborhood, as is the neighborhood where Ronalda House and Sika is, the West End, Trade Street, and what's happening on that. Now you have a patchwork of interesting neighborhoods, each beginning to have different feels. And you now have a cross-section of neighborhoods that really are how interesting cities and communities work. I mean, we go from different neighborhoods and experience those things while still being part of that bigger piece of whatever the community is.
It seems like, from my perspective as an infrastructure freak, that interconnectivity is a missing link in terms of connecting those spots. How do these things come about to begin to break down those barriers?
The concepts of connectivity, I think, are essential. What's nice about Winston-Salem down into Old Salem, it's a relatively compact area, one that can be connected and is already connected to some degree by a series of trails and walkways, but that can be enhanced multiple times, making it a bike-friendly, connected-friendly wayfinding that is really friendly to those who want to do, you know, a day hike or what I call a cultural trail system, by which anyone who lives here all the time can use this the same way that someone who's coming in for the day. Tag that with, you know, some of the technology we have now with the ability to, let's say over the course of those same period of time, we develop public art or activities or various other things that are now tagged so that we have virtual tours that we can use with our smartphones. Again, we're more connected both virtually and through the traffic, so to speak. That virtual can be taken to another level where we're connected as much as we want to when we leave downtown or when we leave the community. We can continue to link into those things that we're interested with. So I think that connectivity, with a little bit of thought and a little bit of work, working together on some of those things, really allow us to magnify a variety of things within the community and a variety of sectors that we begin to see that, you know, just like our neighbors, we're not the same, but we're actually, we're multipliers for each other in our successes.
It strikes me, Jim, that so many of these concepts are, you're not reinventing the wheel. You're maximizing what we have here in a way that we could all appreciate.
I believe strongly that no two communities are the same. However, there are some given central points, and that is using what you have. I'm a big believer in every community has assets. So start from what you have, not what you can't be or what's going to be very hard to be. Elevate what you have and then figure out how much can be gained by beginning to talk and communicate differently to find out how much does overlap in terms of people in different areas of the community wanting the same thing in terms of pushing ahead a little bit.
Is this spine along Spruce Street sort of your focal point for or step one in that direction? In terms of prioritization, where do you see yourself leaning at this point in your tenure?
I think the spine on Spruce Street is definitely one of those pieces. I think showing the vision that was talked about with the Rhodes Center, I don't think it's that far from really being completely actualized. So beginning to make this the center that of activity is will be a focus, because I think it leads very well into many of the other things I talked about: integrated services, development of small business, as well as the new model, which I would like to figure out what that model looks like in Winston-Salem. I think some of the other pieces are figuring out how to become more involved with the development of downtown and the region and using arts and culture for that. I think public art festivals, activities that incorporate, you know, temporary and permanent ways of elevating the region while having things that are specific to, you know, Winston-Salem, I think is another asset. For years, I know that there's been a lot of debate here regarding the challenges related to Greensboro, Winston-Salem, and High Point. And there are. But one of the things I'm taken with is the unique opportunity. When you look at what that is, when you have a Winston-Salem, a Greensboro, and a High Point that are each mid-sized cities to some degree with individual personalities that don't have to lose their individuality or don't have to compete with each other, keep that individual quality, but also can leverage a 1.6 million population. That's a major metropolitan area in terms of the resource without losing that mid-sized flexibility and personality. I don't know many communities in the United States that have that. So if we can figure out how to harness that, we have the best of both. And that is something I think that is really exciting.
President and CEO of the Arts Council of Winston-Salem and Forsyth County, Mr. Jim Sparrow. Jim and the Arts Council recently kicked off their annual campaign. In 2014, they hope to raise $2.65 million to help turn Winston-Salem into a true destination city. You can find out more about the many ways the Arts Council is already supporting and expanding the arts in our community at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Time now for another short break, but fear not, there's still lots of arts yet to come today on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, by the way, and when we come back, we'll be shaking it to High Mass stars, Picasso's Guernica, and much more with High Point University dance professor Kara Hagen. Those are just two of the sources of inspiration she's drawn on for her choreography, and she'll cover lots more territory with me next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Happy Valentine's Day weekend to you. We've got a dark, and I mean dark, Valentine's Day card for you just about 10 minutes from now with Touring Theater of North Carolina's upcoming production of Over the Edge. But for now, it's time to dance. University of North Carolina School of the Arts grad and High Point University professor of dance Kara Hagen is sure tough to pigeonhole, but it's all good because it's all interesting, relevant stuff from choreography to storytelling to film to art projects that raise awareness about domestic violence. Today, Kara's focus is growing High Point University's new dance program in meaningful ways. And this weekend, she'll present the fruits of her labors during the High Point University Dance Concert. It's just the third formal dance concert on the campus, and it's going to rock with two original choreographies by Kara, performed by a group of talented dance students, including the program's very first graduating dance minor. The concert continues through Saturday night with 7:30 performances in Hayworth Fine Arts Center Pauline Theater. It's free and open to the public. Tell me about those early beginnings.
I actually started playing music long before I started dancing. I started playing piano at about 6 or 7. And I always wanted to dance, but it didn't actually happen until I was about 12 or 13. And it was kind of a quick, very sudden realization that this is what I wanted to do with my life. And I remember being in the kitchen with my mom, and I declared, "Mom, I want to bring dance to the people." And I'm still trying to figure out what that means. And every day I'm working toward doing that in whatever way possible. And so that's kind of how it started, and I've been dancing ever since.
There are so many different ways in which you can bring it to the people, and you combine a lot of different elements.
I don't like to limit myself. I like to be able to use anything that I feel is necessary for the project at hand. So if it's a very formal dance concert, that might mean one thing. If it's a community engaged art project, that might mean a very different thing. If I'm working with teenagers, that might mean something. So it really depends on the audience. It depends on the intent of the project and what I feel like I need to say.
Storytelling was one that jumped out at me. I love Nan the Man at the storefront. Do you remember like the opening lines of that? Could you do a little recitation for us?
Yeah. Nan the Man was a man who had only one leg, but he had 8 toes. His mother always told him that God gave him those extra toes just in case his other leg ever decided to come on out. Nan the Man was a simple man. He liked his meat. He liked his potatoes. He liked women, and he loved his cowboy boot.
Cowboy boot. I mean, that's a lighthearted beginning, but many of your tales, you're making a statement, and it's important. Talk about the Wedding Dress Project along those same lines.
Yeah, the Wedding Dress Project is a community-engaged art project whose aim is to raise awareness and inspire dialogue around issues of relationship violence, gender relations, and gender stereotypes. And it's been in existence going on 4 years now. I think when I explain it, a lot of people find it a little strange because one of the main activities of the project are dress deconstruction workshops, where we take wedding dresses that are donated to the project, and I present them to a group of people, and we literally deconstruct them and reimagine them into new pieces of art. And I use wedding dresses not because they push any specific moral agenda or have anything specific to say about marriage, but because everybody recognizes a wedding dress, and it's a catalyst for conversation, and it's a really great conversation starter, especially when you're ripping them apart.
Yeah, I can imagine. What kind of feedback do you get?
Lots of different feedback. In terms of the groups that I work with, sometimes I'm working within a shelter situation. I've worked with homeless communities. I've worked with communities of young women, college students, and high school students. So the feedback is always different. Some of it is intensely personal, traumatic, lots of processing going on. And some of it is really just about envisioning a better society, envisioning a place where violence doesn't exist. And so it really varies from group to group. And the things that I've had made are completely different. I've had superhero attire made, window treatments. I've had bags. I've had pillows. I've had abstract art. I've had quilts. I mean, just anything you can imagine, people make it.
Watching the American Dance Festival and North Carolina Dance Festival preview of Words Apart just gave me kind of a nice little, I guess, a more specific example of combining, in this case, storytelling and movement in some really engaging ways. How did that piece develop, Words Apart?
Yes, so Words Apart developed out of a collaboration between myself and the Storyline Project, which is a wonderful project. They collect stories from our community. When I first approached the project about doing this piece, I asked, well, can I have a bunch of stories and can I pick some? And I wanted to do specifically women's stories and be able to use the piece to show the ways in which women in our community are connected. And so the stories that I picked, I really felt like there was an emotional through line. And it was wonderful because I actually met all of the women. I actually interviewed all of the women. And in one woman in particular, Jan Detter, who's an artist here in the area, I actually ended up making a documentary about her and a piece of art that she made. So it was a very kind of holistic, well-rounded process. There was dance, there was talking and writing, and there was film and just all kinds of stuff. So it was a lovely project.
The clip I saw was a preview, and there was dance in one section, two women dancing side by side on chairs as if they were sitting across each other at a table, engaged in this conversation. I'm hearing stories or back and forths going on. Was that how it spilled out in performance? Was it with spoken word or was it with music, both? How did it?
It was only with the spoken word. We did a little bit of sound design behind the words, but there was no music. And
it's very powerful.
Yeah, it was really an honor to be able to dance the stories.
And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I can't see." I said, "You can't see."
And I went home. I cried all the way home. I walked
the coast, and I nearly died because I could not believe it. And I wanted to do it right, and he wasn't quite sure how to do that.
Now, you went down and you sat on the front row of the church. What was that experience like at Green Street?
When you're setting these pieces on yourself, or when you're laying out the choreography to begin with, to spoken word versus music, any differences there? What's that experience like?
Obviously, spoken word has its own rhythm, and you can find the music within it. During part of the process, I was looking at the rhythm of the words, and during part of the process, I was looking at the emotional aspect of the words and how I wanted to express that on stage. And I think the most challenging thing about that piece was not making it too literal. Do you know what I mean?
Kind of Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, and really being conscientious of where things go when and why, and trying to be cognizant of subtlety and dynamic.
There was one gesture where you do a little quick pat on the lap as if you're agreeing with somebody, and then in a very dramatic gesture following that. And it really, you capture that give and take of a really good conversation.
Yeah, and I think also that happened because I the woman in the video is my twin sister. So we already have a very good rapport with each other. So making the piece and being able to have very deep conversations about how I wanted the piece to play out, and already having such a comfort with each other's bodies and being able to try things and trust each other was a big part of, I think, why that piece turned out the way that it did.
Well, I guess the continuing level for you is bringing dance to High Point University. How's it going? And talk about the program itself.
Yeah, so the program is very new. The program, that's only the second year officially of the program, which is a dance minor. It was my first university job, and it was just something that I kind of dove into, and it's been fun and challenging and trying to think of all the things that you have to think about. None of this exists here yet. How do you collaborate with other departments? How do you make your curriculum align with the goals of the school and provide sound dance training? It's been a fabulous learning experience for me as a newer professor, as somebody who's really just come into the profession over the past couple of years. And I think that the students, especially, have been extremely supportive of the growing and changing nature of the program.
Reaching out to various departments and collaboration, a huge part of the arts, I'm sure campus-wide, but in this case, you're really taking that to the nth degree. From my lens, in a collaboration with Dr. Barlow, an assistant professor of astrophysics.
Yes.
How did that collaboration come about?
I haven't always wanted to be a dancer. When I was 5, I wanted to dig up dinosaur bones and I wanted to travel to space. And I've always been fascinated with, you know, science and everything like that. And I was like, whoa, we have an astrophysics guy. I need to talk to this guy. And come to find out, he's a musician.
How about that?
So that was lucky. So,
because he contributes music to the project.
Yes, he's going to be playing music live for us on stage for the piece. And so we decided that we would depict the life cycle of a high mass star, which sounds really nerdy. But I think from our perspective, it gave us a lot of energetic concepts to work with.
How does the movement pair with that?
Yes. So the movement that we've been working on, a lot of it is very circular. So when we're talking about how stars form and eventually die, there's a lot of ideas about how particles come together and how they separate and how they kind of change from one element to another element. and the energy involved with that. So we have a lot of things that we say in rehearsal. Like, I'll tell the girls, okay, so you're going to rotisserie here, and you're going to particle over here, and, you know, just things like that. I mean, those aren't technical terms or anything like that, but it just kind of made sense for what we were doing.
Well, I got to ask a piece of trivia for a high mass star. What have you learned?
Well, I had no idea that there were so many conversions of elements in the lifetime of a star, especially when it's going through its death. So that was something really fun to learn.
On the program, the second piece, based on Picasso's work, Guernica, a horrifying work created in response to the bombings of Guernica and Basque Village in northern Spain. What about this this huge canvas inspired
you
to think, say, choreography, for example?
A colleague of mine, Dr. Adam Winkle, who works in the Department of Modern Foreign Languages, and I co-teach a class that goes on Maymester to Spain to study Spanish culture, art, and flamenco, dance and music. And one of the trips that we take is to the Reina Sofia, which is a beautiful museum, and the Picasso painting is there. And of course, it's that kind of thing that you see in art history books, and you know what it looks like, but you don't really get the full effect of the painting until you see it up close and personal. So if you haven't seen the painting, it's grayscale. It's all different grays, blacks and whites, so there isn't really any color, but there's so much movement in the painting, just the shapes, the lines, the directions of energy through the painting. And so I had a lot of time to think about it, and I decided that I wanted to make a piece about it. And one of the girls who went with us last year is in the piece, and one of the girls who's going on the trip this year is in the piece. So it gives them some context for what they're learning as well.
And you talked about the movement that's kind of inherent in the painting itself, but could you describe some ways in which it plays out in your choreography?
We talked about a lot of ideas of twisting and contorting with the body, pulling in opposite directions with the body. And so a lot of the phrase work does have that kind of twisting and pulling, and it's very physical. It's a very physical piece because there's a lot of energy in the work. And there's also a lot of places where dancers are kind of piled up on each other or lifting each other because the work is very full and things overlap on each other a lot.
What do you want audience members to get out of this experience? Or what are you hoping the takeaway for them will be?
Well, certainly I hope that for the High Point University community itself, just an expanded view of what this art form includes. And I hope to also be able to bring other people from outside the campus community onto campus so that they can learn about not only dance on campus, but other art happenings on campus as well. There's actually quite a lot that goes on. And I think that it's a wonderful opportunity to invite people into our space and see what we're passionate about.
Dancer, choreographer, storyteller, performance artist, founder and facilitator for the Wedding Dress Project, and High Point University dance professor Kara Hagen. The HPU dance concerts continue through Saturday night at 7:30 in Hayworth Fine Arts Center and Pauline Theater. The performance is free and open to the public, and you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. The Touring Theater of North Carolina's Chamber Series continues with Over the Edge, a collection of short stories by award-winning Triad authors Quinn Dalton, Michael Parker, and Pamela Duncan. The stories are adapted for the stage and performed by Touring Theater's core artists, John Kernodle, Kay Thomas, and actor-director-producer Camilla Milliken. Camilla spoke with me about the two Quinn Dalton short stories she'll be performing as part of Over the Edge.
It's the human experience with the Southern bent. And even though we're playing on Valentine's Day, there's nothing sentimental about them. They are darkly humorous and a black comedy.
Well, let's hear some. How to Clean Your Apartment sounds benign enough. Should we start there?
Sure. Clutter. See also choking, boyfriends, mothers. Let's think for a moment about why you're here. There is, first of all, the matter of the missing man, the man who convinced you to stay in this city of multiplexes and theme restaurants rather than run the rat race in more exciting locales. And there is the matter of the pop-up mother leaping across phone lines from behind doorways, ever hopeful for your marriage and motherhood, words you hear echoed whenever she says, "I just want you to be happy." There are women you know who would climb Mount Kilimanjaro at a time like this, or join the Peace Corps, or start a foundation for a new cause. You've decided to clean your apartment. It's time to take control. Time to reclaim cubic feet of storage space in your closet. Time to give the dog back his favorite corner. How happy do you think he is, wedging himself between a pile of magazines and that dying plant? That will be the first step. Get rid of the plant. But save the clay pot. Maybe you could use it as a doorstop.
What do you love most about this character? What strikes you?
Because she's brave enough to do things that so many of us, including myself, maybe aren't brave enough to do. Spending a day soul searching and going through past experiences and the clutter that is the metaphor for our life, probably, and the baggage that we hang on to.
Can we have another read?
Sure. I'm actually doing two stories in Over the Edge, okay. And they're both written originally by Quinn Dalton. My second piece is entitled Graceland. We just go into the inner workings of a woman's brain about how she arrives at an action. Why am I so angry? I've spent up to $125 an hour trying to answer that question. I could blame it on my weak, binging father, but that seems too simple. I could blame it on growing up large for my age so that I could beat up high school boys when I was in the sixth grade, an ability I grew to enjoy. I could blame it on being a woman, because when a woman learns to like fighting, she doesn't do it for sport or to make a point. It isn't a form of communication the way it is with men. It's attempted murder every time. I've never quit a fight until someone pulled me off. Putting someone on the ground wasn't enough. That night, I watched the fireworks over Graceland from our hotel room, and that's when I decided how to do it.
Touring Theater of North Carolina actor, director, producer Camilla Milliken. Touring Theater's Chamber Series continues with Over the Edge through February 15th, with shows at 8 o'clock in the Mac & Mac Showroom in Greensboro. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. If you missed part of the program, you can always catch it on our website, along with archived episodes and podcasts at WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd love it if you'd share them with us. Please send your email to triadarts@wfu.edu. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.